cold. The cooing of the honeyed girl next to him, sighing and dangling her feet over the water, cooled the burning and brought him back to the moment. She was speaking to him, but he didn't hear. His mind couldn't stop moving. It circled the Harold Dean problem again, then settled back on light bulb. Fucking light bulb. He couldn't believe it, but he had to. Light bulb had tipped his hand when they were in the apartment 2 weeks ago. He hadn't been around much. He was also using, which meant that when Lightbulb made deliveries, he might be cutting the stuff with baking soda or whatever he could get his hands on, diluting the goods to keep the good stuff for himself. Rage climbed into Deems's clear thinking. It was a mistake, he knew, but he couldn't help it. He dipped his hand right then and there in the apartment. He spit out the words. "Say what?" Phyllis was talking. She was so sweet, her voice lovely and lilting with that southern accent was a turn-on. She was almost like a real woman, like the black chicks he'd seen in the movies and on TV, Diane Carroll and Cicely Tyson sitting there looking fully grown with her fine self. He felt like a movie star and a grown man all at once, too, sitting next to her. He was embarrassed that he didn't have much experience with girls. She was 24, 5 years older than him. Most of the girls he knew were younger and worked for him. The older ones occasionally screwed him for dope, or simply became whores for their own habit, which made them untouchable. This little honey was so fine and smart, it seemed a waste to let her get all fucked up on heroin before he got his dibs. Plus, she was a little cold and distant, which made her irresistible. She'd agreed to walk with him to the dock, where there were plenty of empty corners, perfect places for a guy to get his nuts dipped. It was better than risking his life using an apartment of some dopehead in the cause who might set him up for the price of a $10 bag of brown skag. She looked at him oddly, waiting for his response. He shrugged and said, "It ain't nothing." Then gazed out over the water at the twinkling lights, which began to appear one by one as the sun made its last descent over the western skyline. He said, "Look at them lights. Nice. The very next thing I'm going to get me is an apartment in Manhattan." "That's cool," she said. He placed his arm around her shoulder. She removed it. "I ain't that type of girl," she said. He snickered, slightly embarrassed, aware that Beanie was 15 feet off, packing a Davis 380 caliber handgun, watching their backs. "What type of girl are you?"
"Well, not that type. Not yet. I don't know you that good."
"That's why we're here, baby," she laughed.
"How old are you?" she asked.
"Girl, we ain't gonna bang skins out here like teenagers, if that's what you asking, not with him standing right there." He nodded to Beanie.
"We come out here just to see the water and cool out and talk." "Okay. But I need a little bit of something, you know? I'm just feeling it. You know, you ain't gonna ask me to do a little extra here for it, are you?"
He was disappointed.
"Girl, I don't want no extra. Not right now. You need a hit, I'll give you a hit." "Forget it," she said. She tilted her head side to side as if she were thinking about something, then said, "Well, I probably could use a little taste," she said. He glared at her.
"I thought you said you wasn't hooked."
"I ain't talking about doing no works. I'm talking about tasting you, boy."
She tapped his pants near his zipper. He chuckled. Once again, he had a fleeting feeling of sudden alert and would have driven into that feeling further had he not been interrupted by the sound of Beanie behind him bursting into laughter and saying,
"Deems! Oh, shit! Check this out!"
He turned around. Beanie, a good 10 feet off, was standing next to old Hot Sausage, of all people, who was stone drunk and without his stupid pork pie cap. He was dressed instead in the garb of an umpire, complete with jacket, cap, and chest protector, and holding the face mask in his hand. He swayed unsteadily, completely blitzed. Deems scrambled to his feet and stepped over to them.
"What you doing here, Sausage?" he said, snickering. "You drunk? It ain't Halloween yet."
He could smell the booze. Sausage was totaled and looked so ready to collapse that Deems almost felt sorry for him. Sausage was bombed.
"It wasn't my idea," he slurred. "But being that as you, well, I was told if you seen this here umpire outfit, it will be a message."
"What are you talking about?" Deems said.
An idea was forming in his head. He glanced at Beanie, who was still laughing, and at Phyllis, who had wandered over. He pointed in the direction of the park, several blocks away.
"Baseball field's that way, Sausage," he said. "Can I speak to you, private, a minute?"
Sausage asked. Now Deems smelled a rat. He glanced around. The dock was empty, save Beanie, the new girl Phyllis, and Sausage. Behind them, the empty paint factory lay dark. Sausage, despite his inebriation, seemed nervous and was breathing hard.
"Come see me tomorrow, when you ain't drunk. I'm busy here." "It won't take long, Mr. Deems."
"Don't Mr. Deems me, motherfucker. I hear you talking about me at the flagpole. You think I'm sitting around sucking eggs while you sneaking sport coat about? If it wasn't for my granddaddy, I'd have knocked your teeth out 2 weeks ago, you and sport. You two old bag motherfuckers starting up shit."
"Give me a minute, son. I gotta tell you something. It's important."
"Open your talking hole then. Go ahead."
Sausage seemed terrified. He glanced at Phyllis, then at Beanie, then back at Deems.
"It's private, Deems. I'm telling you, man to man, it's about sport coat."
"Fuck sport coat," Deems said.
"He wants to tell you something important," Sausage insisted. "In private."
"Fuck him. Get the fuck out of here."
"Show some respect for an old man, would you? What have I ever done to you?"
Deems thought it through quickly, checking off boxes in his mind. His crew was at the flagpole. Chink was in place. Rags was in place. Stick had a crew of kids on the roofs. Beanie was there with him, packing heat. He was packing heat himself. Lightbulb was, well, in place, and far distant, and no threat, and was a problem that would be dealt with soon. He glanced at Phyllis, who was dusting off her pretty rear end. She took a step back toward the empty paint factory.
"I'll go away for a minute," she said. "You can talk."
"Nah, girl, stay here."
Hot Sausage said to Phyllis,
"I think it's best you go." "Get off her, Sausage."
"It's just a minute, Deems. Please give me a minute in privacy, will you? For God's sake, boy, just a minute."
Deems lowered his voice, enraged now.
"State your business right now, or I'll knock every chiclet out of your mouth."
"All right,"
Sausage slurred. He glanced at Phyllis, then said,
"Sister G, you remember her?"
"Out with it, motherfucker."
"Okay, then."
Sausage cleared his throat, swaying drunk, trying to control himself.
"Sister G come by the boiler room today when me and Sport was there having a taste, you know? She said the cops been asking lots of questions. She come upon some information from one of them cops that she give to Sport Coat. He wanted you to have it.
What kind of information?
Somebody's coming to get you, Deems. Someone bad.
Tell me what I don't know, old man.
Somebody named Harold Dean.
Deems sucked his teeth and turned to Beanie. Beanie, get him the fuck out of here. He turned away and suddenly noticed out of the corner of his eye a movement to his right. The girl. She had stepped away from him, and in one smooth motion, she slid her arm into her leather jacket, pulled a .38 caliber short-nosed Colt, aimed it at Beanie, and pulled a hammer on it. Beanie saw her and tried to reach, but he wasn't fast enough. She dropped him, pivoted to Hot Sausage, who was backing away, and popped him once in the chest, which sent the old man reeling to the deck. Then she turned the gun on Deems. Deems, standing at the dock edge, leapt backward into the harbor when he saw the light wink from the eye of a Colt. When he struck the water, he felt his ear, still healing from Sport Coat's blast, burning. Then the cool waters of the East River surrounding him. Then an explosion of pain bursting out of his left arm, the pain seeming to paint his whole body, which felt as if it were ripping apart. He was sure his left arm was gone. Like most kids who grew up in the cause houses, Deems had never learned to swim. He'd avoided the filthy harbor and the project's pool, which was used mostly by the white residents from the surrounding neighborhood and was policed by cops who discouraged the project's kids. Now, in the river, he flapped his hands uselessly and reached out desperately with his right hand. As he did, he swallowed a gulp of river and heard a splash of someone landing in the water near him and thought, oh shit, that bitch jumped in. Then he went down again, and for the first time since he was a child, in the darkness of the water, he found himself calling on God, asking for help, pleading, please help me, swallowing more water and panicking as he flailed. Help me now, God, and if I don't drown, God, help me, please. Every lesson he'd learned in Sunday school, every prayer he'd uttered, every pain he'd felt in his young life, every sorrow he'd caused that stuck in his craw and nagged his conscience, like the gum he stuck under the pews of Five Ends Baptist Church as a kid, felt like they had risen up in a swirl to create a necklace around his neck that choked. He felt the current grab his legs, toss him to the surface, where he took a desperate gulp of air before it snatched his legs and pulled him down again. For good, this time. He couldn't resist. He felt himself being gently sucked away by the current and was suddenly exhausted and could no longer fight back. He felt urgency seeping from his feet and felt blackness coming. Then, something grabbed him by the jacket and pulled him up into air. He was yanked backward, slung against one of the deck pilings, and pinned there, held fast by a single strong forearm. Whoever was holding him was out of breath. Then he heard a harsh whisper. Shh! He couldn't see a thing in the pitch black. Deems's left shoulder burned so badly it felt like it had been dipped in acid. He was dizzy and felt warm blood oozing down his left arm. Then the grip that held him loosed for a moment to get a better grip and pulled him farther back under the wooden dock and closer to the shore. He felt his feet touch rocky ground. The water was neck-high now. Whoever held him was standing. Deems tried to stand himself, but he couldn't move his legs.
Jesus,
he gurgled. A hand quickly slammed over his mouth, and a face moved close to his, speaking just over his shoulder.
Shh now,
the voice said. Even in the water, with the stench of the dock and the fish and the funk of the East River everywhere, Deems could smell the booze and the smell of the man. The personal body funk of the old Sunday school teacher who had once held him in his lap by the warm wood stove at Five Ends Baptist when he was a howling boy of 9 with wet pants because his mother got too drunk to go to church on Sundays and sent him alone in piss-smelling church clothes, knowing that the old drunk Sunday school teacher and his wife, Hetty, would put shoes and clean pants, shirt and underwear on him, clothes once worn by their blind son, Pudgy Fingers, knowing that Hetty, each and every Sunday, would discreetly carry Deems's soiled clothes back to her apartment in a bag she carried to church expressly for that purpose, along with a Christmas Club money box in which the two faithfully dropped 50 cents each week, 25 cents for Deems, and 25 cents for their own son, Pudgy Fingers. Then she'd wash Deems's clothes and send them back to his mother's apartment in a paper bag with a piece of cake, or a piece of pie, or some fried fish for the children. True Christian kindness. Real Christian love. A hard woman showing hard love in a hard world. Her and her husband, a straight up and down drunk who years later would show the boy how to throw a pitch at 90 miles per hour and kiss the outside part of home plate with it, which was something no 18-year-old kid in Brooklyn could do. Sportcoat held Deems against the piling, his old head cast upward, his old eyes peering through the slats in the pier walkway. He listened intently until the sound of the girl's running feet passed overhead, rang along the dock, and disappeared toward the paint factory and the street beyond. When all was silent, save the sound of the water lapping up against the pilings, Sportcoat's grip on Deems loosened, and he spun Deems backward and yanked him toward the shore, pulling him like a rag doll till they reached the rocks. He laid him on his back on a sandy stretch near the rocks and sat next to him, exhausted. Then he called out to the docks directly above where they sat.
Sausage! You living?
There was a gurgled response on the deck.
Shit, Sportcoat said.
Deems had never heard the old man curse before. It felt sacrilegious. Sportcoat moved toward the edge of the dock to climb onto it, then dropped to one knee, his spent face illuminated by the lights of Manhattan just across the river.
I got to catch my breath, Sausage, Sportcoat called out. I can't move quite yet. Just a minute. I'm coming.
Sausage gurgled again. Sportcoat glanced at Deems, who still lay on the sand, and shook his head.
I don't know what got into you, he panted. You don't listen to nobody.
That bitch shot me, Deems gasped.
Oh, shush. Your good arm ain't hurt.
I didn't know she was packing.
That's the problem with you young'uns. If you'd have growed up down south, you'd know something. This city don't teach y'all nothing. I told Sausage to tell you. Sister G passed the word about Harold Dean coming to kill you.
I was on the lookout.
Yeah? Why didn't you look past your little wee-wee then, which I expect was stout and hard as a bone? Harold Dean was holding your hand, son, purring like a kitten and stinking of trouble. Harold Dean, boy. Harold Dean is a girl's name.
The old man stood up and climbed onto the dock where Sausage was. Deems watched him, then felt sweet blackness coming. It came right on time. Chapter 18. Investigation. The fight over the free cheese in Hot Sausage's basement boiler room that Saturday morning would have broken out into a full-scale riot if Soup Lopez hadn't been there. Sister G was glad she'd made him come. It wasn't so much that Hot Sausage wasn't there to dole out the free cheese, Sister G thought, but rather the fact that Sausage was dead, shot and killed the previous Wednesday along with his dear friend, Sportcoat. Apparently, both had been shot and dumped in the harbor by Deems, who also shot himself dead. That's what the early word was. They were just bad rumors. The cause was used to those, Sister G knew. Even so, the whole business hit everyone pretty hard. "Damned Deems," Bum Bum said. "He got the order wrong. He should have shot himself first." She was usually the first in line at the basement ramp door, rising at 5 a.m. to arrive by 6. It was part of a quest she'd begun in recent months to find out who the secret cheese giver was. She hadn't found out yet, but her early arrival confirmed 3 points. 1, that hot sausage wasn't the cheese giver. 2, that her place at the front of the line was always assured, since most of her friends were there early too. And 3, she'd have first dibs on the gossip, since all the early cheese grabbers were friends from the flagpole she'd known for years. That morning, she got there 10 minutes later than normal to find Miss Izzy first in line, having arrived early as usual, chatting with Sister G, who stood behind the cheese distribution table, having been appointed to the sad duty of distributing the cheese in Sausage's absence. Not far behind her were the cousins, Joaquin the numbers runner, and Bum Bum's secret delight, Dominic the Haitian sensation, whose face, she noted, looked freshly washed and whose fingernails looked clipped, always a sign of good sanitation in a man. Behind him were the 2 other members of the Puerto Rican Statehood Society of the Cause Houses. All the heavy hitters of news, views, and gossip were there in perfect formation. Today had all the makings of good conversation and excellent hot gossip. She sidled into her honorary place at the front of the line just behind Miss Izzy, who had saved her a spot, and slipped in just in time to hear Miss Izzy give her views on the matter. "Sportcoat had been drinking himself to the quit line for 20 years, she said. "But I didn't think Sausage drank that much. Maybe they got into a fight and shot each other." "Sausage didn't shoot nobody," Bum Bum said. Standing in line behind her, Dominic, who just happened to rise at 5 a.m., and just happened to arrive at the basement door at 6 a.m., and by golly, just happened to find himself lined up behind Bum Bum after trading places with several people in line so that he could move up, agreed. "Sausage was a good friend," he said. Joaquin, several spots behind them, looked strangely sad. "I borrowed $12 from Sausage," he said. "I'm glad I didn't pay it back." "God, you are cheap," Miss Izzy said. She was standing a good 5 people ahead of her ex-husband and stepped out of line to address him. "You're so tight with money, your ass squeaks when you walk."
"At least I have an ass," he said.
"Yeah, 3. One's on your face."
"Pig. Gilipollas. Pero."
A man at the back of the line yelled at Miss Izzy to get her fat ass back in line.
"Mind your business," Joaquin snapped. "Make me, Joaquin," he hollered.
Joaquin stepped out of line, and a general ruckus was about to get out of hand, but was quelled by Soup, the giant, who stepped in, looking somber in his Nation of Islam suit. Sister G quickly intervened, moving from behind the long table piled high with cheese and gently coaxing Soup aside.
"Can you all keep your heads, please?" she said. "We don't know what happened. We'll know more later."
Later came right away, as there was a bit of shuffling at the entranceway. Sister G watched as the cheese line that snaked out the door suddenly shifted. Several people stepped aside, and Sergeant Potts stepped into the boiler room. He was followed by his young partner and 2 plainclothes detectives, all business, who squeezed past the line that jammed the doorway and into the middle of the suddenly crowded boiler room, which fell silent. Potts looked at the table where Sister G stood, then at the nervous residents waiting in line. He noticed movement out of the corner of his eye and saw three people, one woman and two men, step out of line and slip toward the exit without a word. He guessed they were either parolees or had outstanding arrest warrants. A fourth, a huge, young, well-dressed Puerto Rican, nearly 7 feet tall, moved to follow. The young man looked vaguely familiar to Potts, and as the big figure moved toward the door, Potts's partner Mitch tapped him and nodded at Soup. "You want me to question him? You kidding? You see the size of that guy?" Soup slipped out, along with the others. Potts turned his attention to Sister G. Even on an early, bleak Saturday in that dank, crowded basement, she looked lovely as an Irish spring morning. She wore jeans and a blouse that she tied at the waist, and her hair tied in a bun with a colorful sash, which set off her lovely features. "Morning," he said to her. She smiled thinly. She didn't seem happy to see him. "Seems like you brought the whole force today," she said. He glanced at the people in line, noticed Bum Bum, Dominic, and Miss Izzy staring at him, nodded toward the three officers and said, "Could you speak to these officers a minute? Just routine. Nothing to worry about. I saw you three at the church is all. We just want to learn about the victims." To Sister G, he said, "Can I speak to you outside?" Sister G didn't bother to tell him that only Sister Bum Bum was actually a member of Five Ends Baptist. Instead, she turned to one of the cousins, Nanette, and said simply, "Nanette, take over." She followed Potts up the ramp and outside. When they were in the plaza, he turned to her, placed his hands in his pockets, and frowned at the ground. She noticed he was wearing a double-breasted sergeant's jacket. He looked quite sharp, she thought, and also bothered. Finally, he looked at her. "I will not say I told you so."
"Good.
But as you know, there's been an incident."
"I heard."
"All of it?"
"No, just rumors. I don't believe in rumors."
"Well, we think Ralph Odom, Mr. Odom, Hot Sausage, the boiler man, drowned in the harbor." She heard herself gasp without really feeling it. She had no plan to howl and lose her face in front of him. She felt foolish suddenly. He was a wonderful stranger, a lovely dream, and now he was just like any other cop, bringing bad news, and probably reports, and more warrants, and more questions, always questions from these types, never answers. "I didn't believe it when I heard it," she said somberly. "I thought maybe Sportcoat was the one that drowned."
"No, Sausage drowned. Our guy, your guy, Sportcoat, is alive. I saw him this morning.
Is he okay?"
"Shot in the chest. He's alive, though. He'll make it."
"Where is he?"
"Maimonides Hospital in Borough Park."
"Why'd they bring him all the way out there?"
Potts shrugged. "Also, Deems Clemens was shot in the left shoulder. He'll live, too."
"Lord, they shot each other?"
"Unknown. Also, there was a third person shot. Randall Collins. He was killed."
"I don't know him."
"Apparently, he had a nickname."
"Everybody does out here."
"Beanie."
"I know him."
She said it curtly, to cut off the choking sound of her own weeping. Once it started, she knew it wouldn't stop. She was not going to cry in front of him. Then the first surge of shock and sorrow passed, and he was still silent. So she spoke again, just to keep her composure.
"What do you need from me?
Any reason your man Sportcoat would want to shoot those two?"
"You know the reason behind it as much as I do," she said.
Potts' glance moved to the rooftop of the plaza building in front of him. He noticed a kid peek over the edge of the roof and disappear. A cop watcher,
he thought.
Actually, I don't, he said.
I saw your sport coat in the hospital this morning. He'd been shot close to the heart. They operated and took out the bullet, but he's okay. He was groggy, sedated. He was kind of confused. We spoke only a few minutes. He said he didn't shoot Deems. That sounds like sport coat. He was drunk when he did it, that first time, anyway. Says he don't remember a thing, which he probably don't. Your sport coat. He says a woman shot them all. Well, I reckon a soul will say anything to stay out of jail. I told him that his buddy Hot Sausage drowned. That hit him hard. Potts was silent a moment as she bit her lip and blinked back tears. You sure he's drowned? She asked.
I'm sure we can't find him.
We found your sport coat in an umpire's outfit. Randall, the dead kid. And Deems, who was wounded. No Hot Sausage. She was silent. I told you this was serious business, didn't I? Potts said. She looked away and said nothing. Were they close friends, those two? Thelonious Ellis, your sport coat, and Mr. Odom? Potts asked. Very close. Sister G thought a moment about telling Potts that there was no Ralph Odom. That Ralph Odom was really Hot Sausage's phony name. That his real name was Thelonious Ellis. And that sport coat's real name was Cuffy Lamkin. And that those two traded off the driver's license from week to week. Yet Potts hadn't said a word about Cuffy Lamkin. Something was wrong. Sport coat did seem concerned about his buddy drowning. He was woozy, but he kept talking about his buddy. I told him we weren't sure his pal Mr. Odom drowned, but the fact is we are. It's pretty clear. We got a witness from the old paint factory who heard the shots and saw Deems fall in. The witness saw Deems crawl out, not the old man. Some of Hot Sausage's effects were in the water as well. Housing authority hat, housing authority jacket. The current was going out by the time the divers got there. The current at this time of the year moves out fast. The water's cold. Bodies sink in cold water. They don't float. Divers will go in later today and retrieve the body. Did you ask Deems what happened?
He's not talking.
I'd have thunk it'd be the other way around, Sister G said. That Deems shot Sport Coat. Or shot them both. Sausage couldn't stand Deems. But Sausage wouldn't shoot nobody. Neither would Sport Coat. Not in his right mind. Sport Coat liked Deems. He loved Deems. Even though he shot him, he still loved him. He was Deems' Sunday school teacher for years. He coached him in baseball. That means something, don't it? Potts shrugged. Just because you toast marshmallows with a kid on a camping trip doesn't mean he'll become a Boy Scout. It's funny, she said. Sport dodged death so many times. Sausage, he never got in no trouble with anyone. You sure it ain't some mistake? They look a little alike, you know.
Is Sport Coat all right?
We checked his wallet, his driver's license with a photo ID. His driver's license ID? She felt a spark go off in her mind, thinking back to Soup's party, when Sausage said that Sport had gone to the Motor Vehicle Bureau and got a driver's license bearing Hot Sausage's real name, Thelonious Ellis, which Sausage had retrieved from Sport Coat at Soup's party. He was even wearing an umpire's costume, Potts added, which I'm told he wears sometimes. That's him, she nodded. But then she thought it through. Even though she saw Sport Coat hand that ID over to Sausage with her own eyes, it would likely take the cops weeks to figure out that the real Thelonious was Hot Sausage and not Sport Coat. Is it possible, she thought, that the two switched the ID again after Soup's party, on the chance that if the cops arrested Sausage, it would give Sportcoat a chance to run. She decided against it. No, Sportcoat wouldn't do that. He'd be too drunk. He's too lazy to think that far ahead. Still, her hopes glimmered a bit. If Hot Sausage was still too woozy to tell them what had happened and who was who, there was a chance. That umpire's vest saved Mr. Ellis's life, Potts said. The bullet hit from the side, and the chest protector slowed it. Otherwise, he would have been cooked. Thing is, he was kind of woozy and garbled in his talk. He wasn't all there, so we'll go back in a day or two and check with him again when he's feeling better.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. And he was talking about a woman. What'd you say his wife's name was?
Hetty.
No, it wasn't Hetty. Something about a Denise Bibb.
Sister Bibb?
Sister G felt another spark go off in her mind. She stared at the ground, working hard to keep her face blank.
She's the organ player at our church. Minister of Music is her real title.
Your Sportcoat said a woman was the shooter, and he mentioned this woman several times, Denise Bibb. Why would he do that? I thought his wife was dead. Sister G bit her lip.
I reckon he had to be out of his head. You said he was woozy, right?
Very much so. Pretty gone, actually. He said some strange things about Mrs. Bibb. Something about her being a killer. A grinder. Strong as a man. A machine gunner. That kind of stuff. Did she have anything against him? You think she might have been involved in some way?
Sister G felt the spark in her head turn to fireworks. I knew it, she thought. Sausage and Sister Bibb had a thing going. She kept staring, willing her face to stay emotionless, before she tried to speak.
Sister Bibb wouldn't hurt a fly, she managed to croak.
It's called evidence. I have to ask.
It's called when you get old, all you got is your imagination, Sister G said.
She tried to make her face take on a grim smile, but was having trouble. The smile now was real. Potts stared at her. That smile, he thought, is like a rainbow. He tried to keep his voice even, official. No other reason to think that this Sister Bibb of yours might have had a grudge against Sportcoat? Lover's quarrel, maybe? Sister G shrugged.
There's plenty tipping going on in church. Just like in any place in this world. People got feelings, you know? They get lonesome, even when they're married. There's love in this world, mister. It don't stop for nothing or nobody. You ain't never seen that?
She looked at him with such desire that he had to stifle an urge to raise his hands like a third grader in a classroom waiting to be called on and reach for her hand. She had unmasked him. She didn't even know she'd done it.
Of course, he managed to say.
But I don't think there's nothing between them, she said. Why don't you ask Sister Bibb herself?
Where is she?
She's in Building 34, but today being Saturday, she mostly works Saturdays at her job. She cooks in the cafeteria in Manhattan.
Did you see her last night?
No.
That was the truth.
She'd seen her 3 minutes ago, in the cheese line. But he didn't ask that.
Sister G felt a little better. At least she wasn't wholesale lying, as her mother would say. Besides, would he ever know? She found herself hoping he would. It meant he'd likely have to come back and she'd see him again. And again.
And again.
I'll keep lying, she thought, just to fold into that big shoulder and see him smile and tell a joke in that heavy, pretty voice he got, the way he did that first day in church. Then she felt acid
creeping into her throat. Ain't I a dreamer, she thought bitterly. He'll be gone when this is all done. Maybe I'll see him sometime outside Radigan's, joking with his buddies while I'm sweeping their bottles off the curb. Thinking of it made her miserable. Potts saw her face fall and was not sure why.
We'll come back later and check with her, he said.
She smiled, a sad, genuine one this time, and felt her heart fall to earth as she said the words that brought light to his heart every time he heard them. Come on back, then. Hurry back, if you wanna. Potts forced himself to check his emotions. He would have slammed the door on them if he could. He was at work. People were dead. There were families to notify, detectives to check up on, paperwork to fill out. They'd rattle this case around the 76th precinct till somebody got tired of it. The best he could get out of it was standing right in front of him, as gorgeous and kind a woman as he'd ever seen. He sighed deeply, offered a small smile, then glanced at the line at the basement door as his fellow officers waited.
We better go back down, lest they think we're out here ordering Chinese.
He turned to head down the ramp until she touched his arm, stopping him. Are you sure that sausage fell into the harbor? She asked.
Not really, he admitted. You can never be sure till you've seen the body.
She followed him down the ramp. He gathered the other three officers, and the four officers filed out in silence. When the cops were gone, Sister G turned to the relieved cheese gatherers, who stood in groups, the line now disbanded. They ignored the cheese, which lay in neat stacks on the table, Nanette guarding them. They gathered around Sister G instead. I thought I said take over, she said to Nanette. Forget that, Nanette snapped. What'd the cops say? Sister G looked at the people staring at her. Dominic, Bum Bum, Miss Easy, Joaquin, Nanette, and the rest, at least 15 people in all. She'd known most of them her whole life. They stared at her with that look, that project's look. The sadness, the suspicion, the weariness, the knowledge that came from living a special misery in a world of misery.
Four of their number were down, gone, changed forever, dead or not. It didn't matter.
And there would be more. The drugs, big drugs, heroin, were here. Nothing could stop it. They knew that now. Someone else had already taken over Deems's bench at the flagpole. Nothing here would change. Life in the cause would lurch forward as it always did. You worked, slaved, fought off the rats, the mice, the roaches, the ants, the housing authority, the cops, the muggers, and now the drug dealers. You lived a life of disappointment and suffering, of two hot summers and two cold winters, surviving in apartments with crummy stoves that didn't work, and windows that didn't open, and toilets that didn't flush, and lead paint that flecked off the walls and poisoned your children, living in awful, dreary apartments built to house Italians who came to America to work the docks, which had emptied of boats, ships, tankers, dreams, money, and opportunity the moment the colored and the Latinos arrived. And still, New York blamed you for all its problems. And who can you blame? You were the one who chose to live here, in this hard town with its hard people, the financial capital of the world, land of opportunity for the white man, and a tundra of spent dreams and empty promises for anyone else stupid enough to believe the hype. Sister G stared at her neighbors as they surrounded her, and at that moment, she saw them as she had never seen them before. They were crumbs, thimbles, flecks of sugar powder on a cookie, invisible, sporadic dots on the grid of promise, occasionally appearing on Broadway stages or on baseball teams with slogans like, "You gotta believe," when in fact, there was nothing to believe but that one colored in the room is fine. 2 is 20. And 3 means close up shop and everybody go home. All living the New York dream in the cause houses within sight of the Statue of Liberty, a gigantic copper reminder that this city was a grinding factory that diced the poor man's dreams worse than any cotton gin or sugarcane field from the old country. And now, heroin was here to make their children slaves again to a useless white powder. She looked them over, the friends of her life, staring at her. They saw what she saw, she realized. She read it in their faces. They would never win. The game was fixed. The villains would succeed. The heroes would die. The sight of Beanie's mother howling at her son's coffin would haunt them all in the next few days. Next week or next month sometime, some other mother would take her place, howling her grief. And another after that. They saw the future too. She could tell. It would continue forever. It was also very grim. But then, she thought, every once in a while there's a glimmer of hope. Just a blip on the horizon, a whack on the nose of the giant that set him back on his heels or to the canvas, something that said, "Guess what, you so-and-so? I am God's child, and I am still here." She felt God's blessing at that moment, thanked him in her heart, for right then she could see that glimmer in their faces too, could see that they would understand what she was about to tell them, about the man who had wandered among them for most of his adult life, whose lymph nodes grew to the size of marbles when he was 18, who staggered around with scarlet fever, hematoid illness, acute viral infection, pulmonary embolism, lupus, a broken eye socket, 2 bouts of full-blown adult measles and several flus, and whose 100-proof body had survived more operations in 1 year than most of them would have in a lifetime. And she felt grateful that the good Lord had given her the opportunity and presence of mind to share it with them. Because in her heart, it was proof that God was forever generous with his gifts. Hope, love, truth, and the belief in the indestructibility of the good in all people. If she could have, she would have stood on top of Building 17 with a bullhorn and shouted that truth for the whole projects to hear. But telling it to this small group, she knew, was enough. She knew it would go far. "Sausage ain't dead," she said. "He was shot, but he's still living. He's in the hospital." "And Sportcoat?" Bum Bum asked. A blanket of silence covered the room. Sister G smiled. "Well now, that's a story." Potts and the 3 officers trooped grimly across the plaza to their squad car. They hadn't gone 5 steps when an unexpected sound from the basement boiler room caused them to stop. They stood in place and listened for a moment. The noise quickly dimmed, and after a moment, the cops started walking again, this time more slowly. One of the detectives fell in step with Potts, who was at the back of the group. "Potts, I don't understand these people. They're barbarians." Potts shrugged and kept walking. He knew there would be strategy meetings, and calls from the mayor's office, and memos from the new drug task force down at the Narcotics Bureau in Manhattan. All a waste of time. And at the end of it, there would still be people who argued that housing projects cases weren't worth spending any more money and manpower on. And now there were three other cops who'd just heard what he'd heard, which would only make his argument that they should pursue this case that much more difficult and inexplicable to the higher-ups, because what the three officers had heard from the boiler room was outrageous. Impossible to anyone who hadn't worked in the cause houses for 20 years, like he had. It was the sound of laughing. Chapter 19. Double-Crossed. It was 2 a.m. when Joe Peck swung the big GTO right onto the dock of Elefante's boxcar with his headlights on bright. As usual, Peck came at the wrong time. The elephant was in the middle of an operation, standing near the doorway of his boxcar, carefully counting the last of 34 brand-new Panasonic television sets that four of his men were hastily transferring from a small docked boat to the back of a Daily News delivery truck. The truck had been borrowed from the newspaper printing plant on Atlantic Avenue at 11 that night by one of his men, a newspaper truck driver. It was due back at 4, when the morning papers rolled out. Peck's headlights swept across the dock and surprised two of Elefante's crew who were holding a crate. The two men, struggling with the crate, hurriedly scampered into the shadows. Their frenzied movement caught the attention of the nervous boat captain, who had kept his diesel engine running. Before Elefante could say a word, the captain motioned to a deckhand who yanked the slipknot tying the boat to the dock, and the boat motored quickly into the harbor without lights, disappearing into the night, the last two Panasonics still on board. Peck emerged from the car mad, stomping over to Elefante, who stood at the door of the boxcar.
"I've never seen that before," Elefante said coolly.
It would not do to get in a dust-up with Joe right here, not while the truck was loading and had to go. There was still money to be made.
"Seen what?" Peck demanded.
"Seen somebody untie a boat that fast. He did it with one pull."
"So?"
"He still got the last two TV sets on there," he said. "I paid him for 34. I only got 32.
"I'll buy the last two," Peck said. "I gotta talk to you."
Elefante looked at the truck. The last TV was loaded and the cargo door closed. He motioned to his men to get the truck moving, then walked inside the boxcar to his desk and sat down. Peck followed and sat in the chair next to it, lighting a Winston cigarette.
"So now what?" Elefante said. He could see Peck was still angry. "I already told you I wasn't doing that Lebanon thing."
"I'm not here about that. Why you got a monkey with my shipment?"
"What are you talking about?"
"You want me to shit eggs standing up, Tommy? I can't move one hairy ball now. The cops are all over me."
"What for?"
"For the thing over at the fishing harbor, at Vitali Pier."
"What thing?"
"Stop bullshitting me, Tommy."
"If you want to talk in circles, Joe, join the circus. I don't know what you're talking about."
"Your guy, the old guy, he cut loose over at Enzo Vitali's pier last night, shot three people."
Elefante carefully considered his response. Years of practice feigning ignorance helped him to keep a tight, straight face when he needed it. In his world, where rigor mortis was a job hazard, it was always better to pretend you didn't know, even if you did. But in this case, he had no idea what Joe was talking about.
"What old guy, Joe? Stop fucking with me, Tommy."
Elefante closed the door to the boxcar, then undid his tie, tossed it on the table, and reached into his drawer and drew out a bottle of Johnny Walker scotch and two glasses.
"Have a drink, Joe. Tell me about it."
"Don't play bartender with me, Tommy. You think I'm a fucking mind reader? What's going on in your head? You losing your marbles?"
Elefante could feel his patience fading fast. Joe had a way of pushing his buttons. As he looked at Peck, his face took on a calm grimness. Peck saw the expression change and cooled quickly. When Elefante was mad, he was spookier than voodoo.
Easy, Tommy. I got a problem.
Once again, for Mother Mary, what is it, Joe?
Elefante asked.
The Lebanon shipment is 9 days off and I've been screwed. I had to get Ray at Coney Island to make the pickup. I don't want to know about it. Tommy, would you let me finish? You know the old paint factory where we used to swim? Enzo Vitale's old pier. Your old guy, your shooter, plugged 3 people down there yesterday.
I don't have no old guy shooting for me, Elefante said.
Tell that to the dead guy taking a nap with bullet holes in his face. Now the cops are all over me.
Would you come up the street level, Joe?
I didn't have nobody down at Vitale's last night. We spent the night getting ready for this haul. 34 TV sets from Japan. Till you came. Now it's 32. The other two are at the bottom of the harbor by now.
I told you I'd pay for them. Keep your dough and use it to go dancing next time I got an operation going. It'll make my life easier. I'm glad you came, though. Showed me what I already knew. That boat captain is just the lizard I thought he was.
So, you didn't have those guys shot?
What do I look like, Joe? You think I'm stupid enough to set fire to money in my own pocket? Why would I have the cops rattling the docks when I had a shipment to move the next day? I had something going.
Peck's anger eased a little. He reached for a glass and poured himself a shot of the Johnny Walker. He sipped deeply. Then said,
You remember that kid? The little whiz kid who worked for me in the cause houses. The one who got himself shot by that old bird. Well, last night the old bird came back with a second old bird to finish the job. The two of them shot the kid again. Didn't kill him, if you can believe it. This kid will give a gunman blisters before he keels over. But they killed one of the kid's crew. One of the old guys got plugged. The old guy, your guy, I think. He's dead too, I hear. Floating in the harbor someplace. The cops are dragging for him tomorrow.
Why do you keep calling him my guy? I don't know him.
You should. He's your gardener.
Elefante blinked hard and sat straight up. Run that by me again?
The old guy, the one who shot the kid and got tossed in the harbor without instructions, he's your gardener. He worked in your house for your mother.
Elefante was silent a moment. He stared at the desk, then glanced around the room as if the answer to this new problem were hiding in the nooks and crannies of the dank old boxcar.
That can't be right. It is. I got it from a bird in the 7-6.
Elefante bit his bottom lip, thinking. How many times had he told his mother to be careful who she let in the house? Finally, he said,
That old drunk can't shoot nobody. Well, he did.
That old man drinks so much you can hear his stomach slosh. The fucker can't stand up straight. He uses a mason jar for a jigger.
Well, he's drinking all he wants now. Harbor water.
Elefante rubbed his forehead. He poured another drink and gulped it down. He blew out his cheeks, then swore softly.
Shit. Well?
I'm telling you, Joe. I didn't know a thing about it.
Sure. And I'm a butterfly with a jag.
I swear on my father's grave, I don't know nothing about it.
Peck poured another shot of Johnny Walker for himself. That was a pretty heavy denial. He'd never heard the elephant mention his dead father. Everybody knew the elephant and his old man had been close.
It still screws me up, Peck said. There's cops all over Vitale Pier now. And guess where Ray was going to make my pickup?
Elefante nodded. Vitale Pier would have been good. Unused. Vacant, deep water, dock still half usable. This was a screw-up, to be sure.
When are the things from Lebanon coming?
9 days.
Elefante thought quickly. Now he saw the problem, or the beginning of it. Once again, he thought, Joe's dropping a bomb on me. The shooting would bring, had brought, the cops. He realized that the only reason the heat hadn't descended on him tonight was because the night duty captain at the 7-6, whom he regularly paid off, was a good Irishman who kept his word. Elefante had tried to reach the captain today and couldn't. Now he knew why. The poor cluck must have twisted like an octopus to keep squad cars and homicide detectives from trolling through his dock and was likely afraid to pick up the phone, thinking internal affairs was on to him. This kind of heat, three shootings for Christ's sake, brought the papers and full-blown attention from headquarters down on Center Street. No precinct lieutenant or captain could hold off that kind of heat for long. Elefante made a mental note to send the captain an extra tip for his diligence. Things will cool down by then, Joe.
Sure. And the Bed-Stuy bastard gunning for my territory is at a peace conference right now, Joe fumed.
Maybe he's the guy behind all of it.
That's what I come to ask. You think your old guy worked for him? Was he that type?
I don't know him, Elefante said. I spoke to him once. But he couldn't pull this kind of stunt. He's old, Joe. The guy's so drunk he gets spirit messages from his dead wife. He paused. He wanted to say a deacon at his church, but he wasn't quite sure what that meant. The old bird had told him, but in the thrust of the moment, he forgot. Peck's raspy voice cut into his thoughts.
He's a what?
A lush, Joe. A drunk, damn it. The guy couldn't see straight enough to shoot an elephant in a bathtub, not to mention somebody on Vitali Pier in the middle of the night. How's an old geezer going to hit two young guys who are likely scrambling and shooting back in the dark? The guy can barely stand up. He's a gardener, Joe. Works with plants. That's why my mother got him. You know how crazy she is about plants. Peck considered this.
Well, she's going to need a new gardener.
I didn't know he had anything to do with this kid. What's his name? The kid that started it all.
Clemens. Deems Clemens. Honest kid. Didn't start nothing.
Elefante listened, aware of the irony. Honest kid. A dope seller. Didn't start nothing. And the old guy, he said. What's his name?
I was going to ask you that. You got so much money you don't know who you're paying?
My mother paid him. I can't remember his name. He's at the church there. He nodded over his shoulder toward the next block, where five ends sat. Then he said it. He's a deacon. Peck looked puzzled.
What do deacons do?
He asked. Carry eggs around, pay bar bills, quilt spaghetti.
I don't know, Elefante said.
That ain't the question to be asking. The question is, who's behind it? If I was you, that's what I'd be asking.
I know who's behind it. Goddamn nigger bastard in Bed-Stuy. Bunch Moon's been trying.
I don't want to hear no names, Joe. I don't want to hear no more about any shipments. That's your business. My business is this dock. That's all I'm concerned with. I can work with you on anything involving my dock. That's it. As it stands, that thing at Vitali's is going to make me radioactive for a while.
What do you expect? Joe said.
You got a couple of birds down at the 7-6. I got one or two ants in that colony, too. Let's find out what happened.
We know what happened.
No, we don't. That guy was so old he sips his booze through a straw. He can't shoot two young dope slingers. Even with the second old guy, he couldn't do it. Those young dope guys, they're fast and strong. Whoever fed you that story is wrong.
A cop told me.
Some of those goons at the 7-6 couldn't fill in the return address on an envelope. Those kids were moving around unless they were tied up. Those boys from the cars selling that crap are big, strong kids, Joe. I used to see them playing baseball against the watch houses. You ever see one of them with their shirt off?
They're going to let an old man, or two old men, if it was two, tie him up and bang away at him? The only way they could have aired those kids out was if those boys were necking like girl and boy. He paused to consider. I could see that. If it was two teenagers kissing or something, yeah, I could see it.
Well, he did say something about a girl.
Who did?
My bird in the 7-6. He read the report. He said the report didn't say anything about a girl, but somebody mentioned a girl.
Who mentioned a girl?
Well, that's the other thing I forgot to tell you. Potts Mullen is back in the 7-6.
Elefante was silent a moment. Then he sighed.
Gotta hand it to you, Joe.
When you bring trouble, you always bring it in threes. I thought Potts was gone.
What are you blaming me for? Joe said. Potts was gone. My guy told me Potts got sent to 103 in Queens, then crossed a captain out there by trying to be a super cop and got busted from detective back to blues. He's a sergeant, or close to it. They say Potts was telling some of the guys in the squad cars to look out for a girl shooter. Said he'd heard there'd been a girl at the dock.
How'd he find that out?
Potts told my guy he went into the old paint factory behind Vitali Pier and found a drunk back there who saw it all. The guy told Potts there was a girl.
You talked to Potts?
Peck looked scornful. Right. Me and Potts go to sit down and sip ales and sing Irish ditties. I can't stand that holy rolling Mick bastard.
Elefante considered a moment.
Me and Potts go back a ways. I'll talk to him. You'd be dumb to try to grease him, Peck said as a warning.
I ain't that stupid. I said I'll talk to him. I'll go to him before he comes to me.
Why are you going to ask for trouble? He's not going to tell you nothing.
You forget, Joe. I run a legitimate business here. I rent boats. I got a construction company. I run a storage place. My mother walks around the neighborhood looking for plants. I can ask him about a dead guy in the harbor around here, especially since the guy worked for me. For Ma, really.
Peck shook his head slowly. This area used to be safe before the coloreds came.
Elefante frowned. Before the drugs came, Joe. It's not the coloreds. It's the drugs.
Peck shrugged and sipped his drink. We'll work this one together, Elefante said. But you keep me out of that other business. And spread the word to those so-called honest kids of yours that my mother had nothing to do with that shooting at Vitali's. Because if something happens to her while she's walking around here picking daffodils and ferns and whatever the fuck else she feels a need to gather up, if she so much as falls down and scrapes a knee, they'll be out of business. And so will you. What you making something out of nothing for? Your mama's walked these lots for years. Nobody bothers her.
That's just it. The old coloreds know her. The kids don't.
I can't do anything about that, Tommy.
Elefante rose, downed his drink, put the bottle of Johnny Walker back inside the desk drawer, and closed it.
You've been told, he said.
Chapter 20. Plant Man. Sportcoat lay on a battered couch in Rufus's basement. He had been there, by his count, for 3 days, drinking, sleeping, drinking, eating a little, sleeping, and mostly, Rufus acknowledged curtly to him, drinking. Rufus came and went, delivering news that was not so good, not so bad. Sausage and Deems were alive and in the hospital in Borough Park. The cops were looking for him. So was everyone at his various jobs, Mr. Itkin, the ladies from Five Ends, including Sister G, Miss Fourpie, and assorted customers he did odd work for. So were some unusual-looking white men who had come over to the cause before. Sportcoat didn't care. He was consumed with the events around fishing Deems out the water, the feel of being in the harbor water at night. He had never done that. Once many years ago, when he first came to New York, when he and Hetty were young, they'd agreed they would try that one day. Just jump into the harbor at night to see the shore from the water, to feel the water and what New York felt like from there. It was one of the many promises they'd made to each other when they were young. There were others. See the giant redwood trees in Northern California,